There are major challenges facing the world today as associated with changes in global climate. These changes have far-reaching implications for weather patterns, ecosystems, and economies. Rigorous scientific analysis must assess the risks, uncertainty, and opportunities clearly. UC San Diego researchers seek to understand the environment on all spatial and temporal scales, enable effective use of that knowledge, and engineer solutions in global societies. At the same time, finding feasible and effective measures to respond to environmental risks requires fresh thinking about political, economic, and social forces that determine our set of choices. You might think about the global climate system as comprised of three components: the ocean-atmosphere system, natural and human infrastructure that we are interested in protecting, and the forces at work that can drive changes in the climate system. The real system is very complex, with all of these components closely interconnected and affecting each other. Some of the challenges that we're facing are associated with uncertainty in our understanding of this system and in defining the associated risks. One of the objectives for research is to convert this uncertainty to predictive capacity and to identify opportunities for solutions. Our first group of speakers will describe some of the work being carried out here at UC San Diego that is expanding our understanding of the global climate system. Dr. Richard Carson from the Department of Economics will address how research on economic systems is creating opportunities for reductions in emissions to minimize effects on climate. Richard Carson is a professor of economics, a longtime UC San Diego faculty member. His recent work has focused on forecasting Chinese carbon dioxide emissions, quantifying the benefits of major changes to British water quality regulations, examining the labor market impacts of widespread arsenic contamination of shallow tube wells in rural Bangladesh, looking at the role incentives play in the purchase of new electric vehicles in California, and preserving a large tropical rainforest in Malaysia.
Let's see, as the economist in the group, I'm always the one with bad news. How much carbon dioxide do Matthew and Gino have to deal with in their models? And what you can see is that most of the attention in the last several years has turned to China. And UCSD has a tremendously good group of people working on all aspects of China, and we'll see this as we go along. But first, I should say, since this is a Founders Day symposium, it was Roger Revelle who got me interested in forecasting greenhouse gas emissions, and forecasting has long been sort of a strong suit of the economics department. The science literature has concentrated on this identity and variations of it, which says impact, think carbon dioxide, is equal to population, times affluence, think income, times technology, where usually the notion was to improve things, we would have to reduce population, keep income down, which was never popular, and do something on the technology side. Well, economists have looked at this relationship hundreds and hundreds of times across large numbers of countries, and we never see anything like the iPad equation. What we see is this inverted U-shaped structure that what happens when countries are really poor, what, they have a rural agrarian economy, so they're not producing lots of pollution. But as they get richer, pollution levels go up, but at some point, the countries start using that extra income to deal with the pollution. So if we were to look at it currently, who's sort of way over here on the right? Norway. Norway has almost no pollution anymore. Everything's driven by renewables and hydro. The most popular car now in Norway is a Tesla. And I'm just going to give you an illustration of how similar two major coastal cities look like with the same income. This is Los Angeles, a la about 1975. This is a bad day, of course. But does this sort of, but you never see days like this in Los Angeles anymore. This is Shanghai. In 2013, it actually looks still the same now. But this is what happens. If you look at China now, where a lot of the focus is, the current estimates are China's killing over 1 million people a year with air pollution. It's a frightening sort of figure. There are all sorts of other reasons why this sort of iPad formulation doesn't really work, and that is population's a very complex interaction with income. When income first goes up, what happens? Infant mortality goes down, so you get population spikes. Then, as income goes up, you want to invest in human capital. In particular, for women, as you invest in human capital, birth rates eventually go down, and countries implement Social Security-type programs, so you don't have the same dependence on your kids or needing to have large numbers of them survive. The technology adoption follows a very different flavor than usually thought. And what you can see is it's mainly driven by energy cost. What happens? When energy costs get really high, the government invests lots in R&D. Private firms invest lots in R&D. And firms adopt lots of new technology to try to deal with this. And so Steffi Fried in the economics department, who's a PhD student, shows that you get a huge dynamic boost from what we call induced technological change by the energy costs. And so we try to do something really strange. We try to hold down energy costs and think about R&D investing. And so when energy is low, nobody has any interest. Then the quality of the regulatory institutions makes a large difference. And there are a group of people in political science and IRPS who work on this issue a lot. Foreign trade decouples consumption and production. So what have we done in the U.S.? We've offloaded all the dirty production to China and other developing countries. And then the cumulative CO2 emissions are influenced by the business cycle in two different ways. What happens? Countries grow at very different rates, and the path that they take to get someplace can vary a lot. So here's some notion of what would happen with fairly simple projections of what CO2 emissions were going to be at four key dates. 1983, the first time the U.S. thought about regulating CO2 emissions. 1992, when we agreed to do something as a set of nations in Rio, which you can see that was the time which the thought was that U.S. emissions were the real problem. Then 1997, when a number of countries signed the Kyoto Protocol. And then you can look more recently at 2007, which was right before the Copenhagen meeting. And what can you see? You can see that the U.S. emissions have dropped precipitously. The Europeans, who talk a really good game, are not really even in it anymore. And the Chinese emissions have just gone up by an enormous amount. So one of the things I do and get in lots of trouble doing is forecast Chinese CO2 emissions. So with a graduate student of mine, Max Offheimer, who's a professor now at UC Berkeley, we forecasted that China's CO2 emissions would pass the U.S. in 2006. Well, this was 15 years before the official estimates which were driving the climate negotiations. And it had large political implications. I do lots of things where it takes 10 or 15 years for anything to happen. In this case, I sent out copies of the paper to people in the U.S. government and the British government, and got a call from the British government. They said, why don't you come to London and give us a briefing? And Tony Blair, 3 days later, gave a speech with the tagline from the paper, which said the annual increase in Chinese CO2 emissions were more than the entire emissions of the United Kingdom. Anyway, the climate sort of negotiations started to unravel at about that point. And we've continued to sort of look at how well our model's done. So what you can see back here is around 2000, things radically changed. That was when the Chinese government and the U.S. government sat down and made it both clear to each other that they weren't going to join the Kyoto Protocol. And at that point, the Chinese technology changed radically. And so we tried to measure this in lots of ways. And so we didn't really have enough data. And so we went and we started modeling each of the Chinese provinces, the 30 provinces. And the other thing we could see is that the technology that they were locking in locked them into a really bad long-run trajectory. So, and that's what we see now. So anyway, in 2012, our model was 1.2% off. And you could sort of see the purple line, the dark purple line, was the official projection at the time. Anyway, everybody's now picked up the way we were modeling things, so that was good. And you can look at the major source of uncertainty now in China is no longer really income. But if you looked at that inverted U-shape, what's it saying? It's saying that actually countries like, cities like Beijing and Shanghai are near the top. And what's going to happen there is that population growth in China coupled with the technology they put in over the next decade are going to be the main driving forces, not income, in China. So we've tried to come up with so economists usually are credited with not being optimistic, but we've been doing lots of work on what happens if you were to put a price on carbon in China. And by a price, we mean a carbon tax, which economists love carbon taxes. That translates into gas taxes and electricity taxes. You can also have cap and trade programs. So that's another way to put a price on carbon. The leaders of the developing countries, China and India in particular, have argued that reducing their CO2 emissions is going to really hinder their development. So what they're doing is they're trading off environmental quality, better environmental quality. And if we were to look at the cities in China, that's the thing that the mayors are really pushing. They know their people really would like to get the air pollution levels down, and they're willing to trade off some of that income. But there are lots of political implications of slowing the growth rate down. And anyway, the expressed opinions of the Chinese and Indian leaders are very consistent with the economic studies of the U.S., which say that you're going to take somewhat of a hit in terms of economic growth if you put on carbon taxes. In a paper that we've just given in China and Washington in the past couple months, Mark Jacobson, who's an associate professor in the economics department, and Anthony Liu, who's a former graduate student here, who's at Resources for the Future in Washington, what we've done is we've shown that if you put on a carbon tax in China big enough to get a 10% reduction in CO2 emissions, that China's economy would grow 1% quicker. Now, I think if you were to tell any U.S. leader you could figure out how to get 1% more economic growth, you know, they would do hand flips and say really strange things about you. but anyway, how do you do this? It turns out there's something very different about developing countries. They have lots of tax evasion. Well, it turns out that environmental carbon sort of taxes are really hard to evade. What do? You have a small number of petroleum refineries that you level the tax on. You have a relatively small number of electric power plants you levy the tax on, so it's very hard to evade. And so that overcomes one of the problems in the U.S. is that you really want to make a tax efficient, you want it to be broad-based. And so that's the problem in the U.S., but you actually make the tax broader in developing countries because of the way it goes on. The other thing you do is it causes the informal sector, which is much bigger in developing countries than in the U.S., to grow quicker. Because what happens? You take the tax revenue and you reduce labor taxes and capital taxes, and that moves activity from the informal sector to the formal sector, which is growing quicker. And the last thing you need is you have to have the sort of bad fossil fuel departments, deposits, in this case coal, in the ground, and they can't get off and walk away. So the problem with taxing lots of businesses, if they don't like what you're doing, they just move across the border. but your coal that's in the ground can't move, so you can actually tax it. And that's sort of the hopeful note that what happens is that these carbon taxes, which everybody in the developing countries feared would cause them not to be able to grow as quick as they want, if done in the right way, and it has large implications too, because there are going to be lots of gainers and losers. So this is not no cakewalk in that sense. But anyway, if you do this in the right way, the developing countries can actually get on board in terms of climate change and do so in a way that causes their growth to actually go up. And the key thing, we've got 10% in here, but to keep doing this, you have to keep fueling R&D into technology. So once you set this process in motion, you can keep cutting the carbon emissions at the rate at which you can do technological progress. Okay, and that's it.